Welcome to the Pain Gap Podcast. Join me as I engage with experts, patients, journalists, legislators, and policy experts. Together, we'll explore intersectional health disparities and advocate for accessible, equitable healthcare for women of all backgrounds. Let's ignite progress and demand urgent action for women's health worldwide. Thank you guys so much for being here, Christy and Jenny. I am so honored. You guys are so special and so important in my advocacy work. And of course, you guys are both in the book and have been so instrumental in everything. Christy, I want to start with you because you are the force behind bringing us together, and Dr. Rebecca Gee as well, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, but really the four of us together. Talk to me about the Giving Birth in America series and the role of education and storytelling in advocacy.
Great. Thanks, Anushay. It's so great to be with you and Jenny always. You're my inspiration in this work every day. But the organization Every Mother Counts was really founded through storytelling. The first movie we made called No Woman, No Cry, which Jenny is actually featured in as we were trying to explore the maternal health crisis in the United States. And I guess about 5 years into the organization's lifespan, we thought it was important to dig a little deeper into the U.S. maternal health crisis. And so we made three short films, a trilogy, examining the challenges and the solutions in three states, New York, Florida, and Montana. And I think with the idea that it was an election year when they came out, and the idea being that we really wanted to put maternal health sort of front and center in that election. And of course, the outcome in 2016 was different than we had anticipated, many of us who have been advocating on behalf of women's health. And so we kind of went straight back in to tell more stories. We went to Louisiana, which is where I met Dr. Gee through that film. And we've since made about six total. So California, New Mexico, and we're embarking on our seventh Giving Birth in America film this year, focusing on the state of Arkansas. So the idea being that there are so many stories to tell across this country globally. And so one way of kind of getting closer to the truth, trying to really understand the barriers and the challenges that women face when trying to bring life into the world, you know, just sort of breaking it down for people so that it feels closer to home than it may otherwise. And so, you know, over the past 5-6 years of making these films, we've had some really great outcomes. Dr. Gee actually hosted a maternal mortality summit in the state of Louisiana after that film came out. We've been on the road as a foursome here, you know, really talking about these issues, using the films sort of to break down the statistics that we are starting to hear more and more about on the front pages of our newspapers and in the news. And so really just trying to get more people to understand, but also to sort of understand where their own healthcare falls into place and to understand who has access, who doesn't have access, to understand the horrific health disparities that exist in this country. It's all just a matter of awareness raising and bringing the stories closer so that we feel the same urgency as our sisters, neighbors, friends, family members in terms of really finding solutions, sustainable solutions for this issue.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like there's a lot more awareness around the fact that there is a maternal health crisis at home. But in 2018, when the series was first premiered, I mean, I even remember just when you hear Giving Birth in America, what you imagine it will be. And then the reality of what it is, what I thought was so powerful and still think is so powerful about the series. Really quick, Dr. Gee, we can see you. And I will come back to you. And I'm so glad that you joined us. That's awesome. I'm going to wrap up with Christy, then I'm going to go to Jenny and then to you. So Christy, my next question to you is, advocates and experts compare the violence and prejudice that exists between law enforcement and African Americans as the same discrimination that follows women of color, especially Black women, into hospitals and delivery rooms across the country. You guys are all featured in my book, but of course, you know, I love this letter so much, and I'm going to quickly read a little bit from it. In the summer of 2020, leading reproductive justice and childbirth advocacy organizations working for birth justice decided to take action.
They seized the moment of George Floyd's death to have painful but necessary conversations about race to make the changes needed to save women's lives. In a full-page ad that Every Mother Counts had published in the New York Times, a national coalition came together and identified concrete actions to combat racism in maternal health settings and protect childbearing people. An open letter presented a moral question to America. How many Black, Brown, and Indigenous people have to die giving birth? So powerful, I'm gonna try not to cry. But I wanna ask you, what was your vision behind that letter?
I mean, it really was, it was a moment, right, for the country after this horrific murder of George Floyd. And in the days after, as we were all sort of sitting in this place of pain and acknowledgement of just how far away we were from justice on every level, on the most basic level. But really, it just was, I think, such a moment in the early days of the pandemic, and then so many murders, actually, but that particular moment. And then days after, there was a maternal death in New York, a woman named Shaija Washington. And I was on a call that morning or the day after, and with some of our partners, and we were all just kind of like, I feel like stunned. We didn't know where to go. It was like, what do we do? And what do we say? And, you know, how do we hold? I mean, like, what's the real question? And it's this piece about accountability. In that case, you know, the institution where Shaija died wasn't coming forth with clear answers or information, not only to the family, but also to the staff and the team that were involved. And it just felt like that's what we really need to do. We really need to press. And we have this idea, you know, obviously op-eds are incredibly powerful, and yet they're really, really hard to get passed through and to get published. And so we thought, we have this moment and opportunity, and how do we ensure that we're gonna get the visibility that we believe is so needed in this moment? And so I thought about, I thought about an ad. I thought about, like, you know, this is something that I feel like has been a powerful tool for communication in the past. And we could guarantee the placement, we could work on the layout. And then, so once we made that decision, then it was a matter of reaching out to our partners and folks on the ground who have been fighting for birth justice for years and years and years, Jenny being a central voice in that fight. And so everyone jumped in very quickly. We somehow managed to write and edit a piece in a relatively short period of time. It's also very hard when you have so many voices and so many different organizations involved. And yet I think it was really that call to the communities of, you know, we have this opportunity and we have this, you know, we have the support of Every Mother Counts to be able to get this front and center, and let's make it happen. And that piece, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Representative Underwood, who is, you know, one of the leaders, a co-leader of the Black Maternal Health Caucus. And she apparently has this ad on her wall framed. And it gives me so much pride to know that this moment mattered. And there's been continued building upon that call out and demand for birth justice, but there's still so much to do. Hopefully in our lifetimes, true progress will be made. But as Jenny can speak to much more specifically, I would say that there's just, like, you cannot put your foot off of the gas with this
issue. No, you can't. And what I really loved about it is how it seamlessly connected, you know, we all get it because we work with the issue, we work in the field, but seamlessly connecting racial justice and birth justice, which, Jenny, brings me to you. You are such a pioneer. Not only are you featured in Chapter 8 alongside Christy and Dr. Gee, but you are actually featured towards the end of the book for pioneering solutions going forward, of course, with the JJ Way. I wanted to talk to you about your historic school for midwives, because, of course, as you know, Black women and immigrant women played such a big role in bringing midwifery, the practice, to the U.S., but of course, over the years have been pretty much erased from it. So talk to me about your first Black-owned and federally accredited midwifery school in America.
Yes, thank you. I'm still excited. It's almost like a dream come true. In 2020, we were able to become accredited. We've been running the school for 10 years at that point, but the national accreditation through the Department of Education was really a pivotal moment for us in that it felt, we felt really strongly that it was necessary to create access through an outside of a university setting or a particular college setting, that you had access to this training, which, you know, centuries has truly belonged to the community. We are training community midwives, community providers, because those are the very people who have sustained communities over millennia. And you're right, in the United States, early United States, it was the African enslaved midwives, it was the immigrant midwives, the indigenous practitioners, and those were the people who delivered each other, everybody, right? So midwifery is how you were born. But as we've Americanized midwifery and the power dynamics have switched, and on purpose as well, it wasn't by accident, that midwifery has been erased. I mean, even now, after many decades of struggle, you know, to bring midwifery back, we are at 10% of the birthing population of the United States. And that really is heartbreaking, because if you go anywhere else in the rest of the entire world, midwifery is the normal practice and the providers of obstetric care for all people. So we are thrilled that we got the school up and running. We are going great guns. We have 25 students enrolled in our current cohorts, diverse students, students across all socioeconomic as well as all races and ethnicities, gender identities. We are so excited because we know that our communities are best served by people from those communities who have a heart and who are trusted inside of those communities, are chosen inside of those communities. So yeah, midwifery, we feel like, is an answer to these outrageous and egregious health disparities that continue to show up, that have America practically dead last as an industrialized countries. And we know that when we re-empower people, then we can address not only their health, but justice at the same time.
Yes, exactly. And I talk to me about the doula training that you guys, you're currently offering, but also the JJ Way going virtual, which initially I think was panic for everybody, but you say you're actually quite happy with.
Yes, we provide a model of care, a midwifery model called the JJ Way, and we do train midwives, doulas, community health workers, lactation educators, and so on. And across these disciplines, what we found is that telehealth and telemedicine is actually a really powerful and a safe way to provide that quality and that equity in the care. So when the pandemic hit, we were able to pivot and provide the same services, the support, the education, the listening, just hearing a person explain their concerns and getting it off their chest is protective and makes all the difference to their outcome. And so all of our trainings and all of our practitioners are employing telehealth now. And we realize that this is a modality that helps us reach even more people. We are able to scale our programs now because of the ability to provide telehealth. We make sure that mothers and families have kits at their home where they can take their own blood pressure, listen to their baby's heartbeat themselves, check their weight, check their urine. We have found a way to really marry remote care, virtual maternity care, as we call it, the JJ way, as well as the usual way of providing on-site in-person care. And we're getting the outcomes. And that gives me so much joy.
Oh, that gives me so much joy hearing you talk about it, Jenny. This is like cleansing for the soul. Dr. Ghee, you're here. Thank you so much. Only you can pop on. Are you still recovering? You're still recovering, aren't you?
From COVID? Yeah, yeah. I had tired, but I'm also a parent of five kids, so that could also be.
You had no option. Well, I won't take up too much of your time. It's actually perfect because you were going to be you're right on time. You were going to be the third person I went to. So my question for you is, you know, we know, I think we can all answer what we think the state of women's health is or give our perspective. But what is your medical perspective on the current state of women's health in America?
So I'll give you a medical word. It sucks. It's awful. You know, as physicians, we spend 4 years learning how to say things in a way that people don't understand so that they think we're really important. But I mean, there's no finessing where we are. It's bad. We, you know, when the Secretary of Health from Brazil was in the U.S., you know, my former role was Secretary of Health, where I led the health department and I led a variety of initiatives to improve quality. And he put his data up to mine. And ours was worse. And here we are in one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest country on this planet. And women are dying. You've heard Jenny and Christy so eloquently say what some of the problems are. So we have a long way to go. We need to support our women and girls. They need to be a much greater priority. And whether it's the state of women's health research, I mean, why don't we know? For example, one thing that's nearly universal in women's lives is childbirth. Why don't we know what causes labor? Why don't we have better treatments for the things that happen to women in pregnancy? And then why aren't we doing the studies? Why aren't we doing studies of medications in pregnancy to make sure we can safely treat the conditions, including mental health conditions women face? Why aren't we doing research on better contraceptives? How come the best new thing was developed in the 1970s, i.e. the IUD? That's not a new technology. And why are women, and then to the policy and kind of personal issues that women face, how come we don't have paid family leave in this country? Why don't we have pay equity in this country? Why are women dying? You know, when we were able to reduce maternal morbidity by 60%, and I'm really proud of that. We focused on health equity. We focused on racism as a driver, and we made a big change. But the bottom line is the leading cause of death in Louisiana is intimate partner violence, women being murdered and victims of violence. Why aren't we addressing this as a society? So there are just so many issues that get shoved under the rug that are so consequential for women and girls. And I am so honored to be with you, Anishe, Christy, and you, Jenny, because you're brave women changing this. But what has to happen, in my view, is women have to be at the table. We have to have more conversations, and we have to be leading where the investments are going. We have to be leading the discussions, because there is a long way. And then just to finish up, I mean, if we think about the state of reproductive rights, you know, I was born in 1975, and I was born at a time and grew up at a time where we thought, you know, feminism wasn't a cool word, and, you know, we've just made it, and it wasn't cool to be a feminist when I was growing up. And I think we see where that went. I mean, women haven't spoken up. Doctors haven't spoken up. There's been a slow and steady stampede on women's rights in terms of our ability to decide our reproductive future. And this has led to, you know, a recent Texas bill that allows family member against family member, community member against community member, vigilantes running around trying to, you know, penalize women and their practitioners and trusted providers for making a choice that's important to them and may even save their life in many cases. And so it's not a great time, but as Gloria Steinem so beautifully said to me when I got to meet her, when I saw the preview of her film at Sundance about her incredible life, you know, it's great to be old because you remember when it was worse. So when I get frustrated, I think about, I am the great, great granddaughter of a Mormon prophet. I think about what my grandmother's vistas were and what my mother's vistas were, and they were much more narrow than what mine have been. And my girls' opportunities will be endless and bountiful. And we are here talking about these issues so that we can change them for our girls. And I have endless optimism about where we can be. But there's a lot of work to do. We're not where we are. And so we have to be in the halls of justice, in the halls of the legislature. You know, when I started as secretary, 11% of our elected officials were women. 11%. So until women's voices are equal at the table, we've got to continue to fight for progress. And that's exactly what all three of you are doing. And it's an honor to be with you today.
Well, that brings me to my next question. And then I'm going to have a last question for everybody and wrap things up. But talk to me about your exciting new healthcare company and what you're doing to, you know, have a intervene to help save women's lives.
Sure. So I'm the parent of five kids. This company comes out of my personal journey, having difficulty managing five children's healthcare, and my husband, who wouldn't get healthcare, you know, unless I shoved him out the door, made the appointment and told him when it was. So, but mostly I think thinking through the lives of low-income women and how challenging it is. Most low-income families are single mother families. Single mothers have a really hard time managing their own appointments, their own health, their kids, different pediatricians, different locations, and a healthcare system that frankly doesn't treat them very well. A healthcare system that doesn't respect and have the types of attitudes about patients I think we should have. And it, for example, I was in North Louisiana a few years ago, and someone said to me, I don't want Medicaid women in my waiting room because I don't like how the waiting room looks with them in it. So just imagine being a mother trying to navigate that and then being treated that way and seen that way just to try to get your child in your self-care. So I created Nest Healthcare. It's a primary care company for Medicaid families, and we're bringing the care to the family. So if you want to get care at home, at church, at a place where it's convenient for you, we'll take care of your kids, we'll take care of you. We'll make sure that we reduce barriers for you. We'll help you navigate social services. And we're investing in pregnancy through age five because the brain development from birth to five is 80% of brain development. And we've got to make sure we are investing in our children. But to do that, and I think we make a mistake here, to do that, we have to invest in the mothers and the parents because healthy, happy mothers make happy, healthy kids. So anyway, I'm excited about it. There is not a single other startup company in this country focused on Medicaid children, if you can believe it. It was hard for me to believe. And wow. I think these notions, I know that Jenny knows from being training in England, that we don't just, in other countries on this earth, we don't just, you know, say, okay, let's have a baby. We'll take money for that. And then I hope you do well. Maybe we'll see you at the postpartum visit, but good luck. I hope you figure it all out on your own. No home visit, no helpers, mm-hmm. no anyone, you know, but if you want to come to our clinic, great. But think about how hard that is with newborn, in my case, babies. I had twins. I mean, bringing, whenever I had to get, have an appointment, take both babies, get them in the car. So anyway, I think this is all something that's solvable and I'm excited to be working on it.
Well, I love that you said that because that is my hope too on days when I just, you know, don't want to get out of bed, is that I feel like the pandemic is giving us a really big opportunity and kind of showing everyone that it is solvable. That's one of my favorite things about working on this issue, that it's not rocket science. It is solvable. We have the resources. Do we have the will? Are women's, is women's health and women's rights a priority? That's another question. But to wrap up, I want each of us just quickly say, what is giving us hope? Because that's giving me hope, you know, the opportunity that the pandemic is giving us. And Christy, I'll throw to you and then Jenny will wrap up.
I would say collaboration. And we've just had a team meeting earlier today. And I think, again, given that we are all in this sort of still remote working scenario, we really had to lean in to our partners and our team members to really have clear and good communication, to really sort of draw from the strengths and skills around us. Not any one of us can do this work alone. And I think really recognizing the value that each individual committed to making the world a better place brings to every room, to every table, to every Zoom conversation. So I really view all of you as collaborators and partners, and I love to do this work with you, and you inspire me.
Thank you, Christy. Well, you inspire me. And Rebecca, you missed it in the beginning, but I was talking about how Christy is the one, right, who's responsible for bringing us all together. So Jenny, what is giving you hope? Your school, your doula training is giving me so much hope.
It is. But you know what's giving me greater hope is I'm feeling the movement swell and grow. I'm feeling we've got some momentum, like we're picking up speed. And are we at that tipping point? I'm hopeful that we are, because once we go over, it's done. Like, there's not, all of the solutions are here. Everybody who's on board already knows and understands what to do. Yes, we need more awareness in the general public, but we can get this done. So I am so hopeful and encouraged because I feel the power showing up. And our work was always about building a movement. You know, we say things such as building a movement to to birth a more just and loving world. I feel like we're close. I feel like we could do it. Never felt so strongly about it as I do now.
Oh, I love that. Me too, Jenny. I love you. Thank you. All right, Dr. Gee, what do you think?
The three of you. I mean, I have to say, it's my friendships with women, the strength that I have from other women, including my own girls, who are so much smarter. They will be so much smarter than I will. I already understand things that I didn't at their age. And so frankly, we're coming out of this pandemic with a better sense of ourselves and each other, of social justice, of equity. The tides have changed. And I know that we will continue to make progress. And you three are powerful. I draw energy from you and hope from you. And, I'm just very optimistic that our world will continue to improve. And It's been an honor to be with you today.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you were able to join. Thank you all so much for your time. Thank you. I will speak to you guys soon. Stay safe.